We have met here today to talk about the well-being of boys and men, half Earth's population. This morning, I described the situation boys face when there is no father. This afternoon, I ask you to think along with me briefly about what we must do on their behalf as public officials, teachers, clinicians, parents, and yes, mentors, this new group. While everyone here must respond, and soon, the urgency to do so must be felt first and foremost by men themselves, I think. Men must take the lead, and I think Celia would agree with me. And I remember that one of our first conversations, and in reading what she has published, her adamant position that while women obviously have a great deal at stake here, it's up to men to make some important moves at this point. Here and everywhere, the situation of boys and young men, especially the generations born since 1970, has put them at risk. They're vulnerable, often disappointed, and not because of over-expectations imposed on them, which had been the case for generations of men through my own, the baby boomers. As documented, many have dropped out of sight or been left behind. All of us here know the details, especially the statistics about rates of school failure, suicide, unemployment, incarceration, ascertained psychopathology, the kind John spoke about earlier. Well, while we wait as the world slowly wakes up to the meaning of these data, and that is happening, but ever so slowly, to my ongoing amazement, I am here, thanks to Dr. John Ashfield. Before opening this session to discussion, we'll have not so much discussion, but for some concluding exchanges, I want to say a few words about what I've been doing, supplement a bit what I said this morning, and suggest what we must do after we leave here later this afternoon. All of this is offered in the spirit of being proactive and, I hope, creative. My position is unabashedly pro-male. We must acknowledge what men do well and celebrate those whom Celia Lashley has so movingly termed our gorgeous boys. And I was not here, and she knows why, but I'll bet she used the word gorgeous more than once, and that's a great word. My interest turned to boys' lives about 12 years ago, when after 30 years teaching many college-age males and working with males of all ages as a psychotherapist, starting age 10 on through the 30s, 40s, I noticed that something had changed. You know, we always see too late that something has changed. In any case, with a few exceptions, my male students were less engaged. They had lost some of their verbal sheen. They seemed less present, existentially less there. They were already increasingly not there at all, physically. As I mentioned in the Q&A, now they account for less than 40% of all college students in the States. And I'm not sure what the numbers are here, but I suspect that they're fairly similar. My observations, in any case, got the attention of a few colleagues in academia. Ah, so you're interested in gender studies and men's studies, they asked. I had heard these terms. This is, again, not so many years ago, 12 years ago. I knew there was a women's studies program on the campus of Wagner College, where I've taught since the mid-90s, but I knew nothing about it firsthand. No, I'm not interested in gender, I would say, not really knowing what I was not interested in. My background was in clinical psychology, and before that in continental philosophy. To be honest, I had not paid much attention to this discipline. I had started reading around, so as a result, and learned there was, by 1999, a 30-year movement called Men's Studies, part of which had been inspired by Robert Bly's mythopoeic revivalism for mostly middle-aged, often damaged men. Sam Keen's fire in the belly had flared up, but was soon reduced to ashes, however, and a certain kind of heartburn resulted, for which there was no ready remedy. As I read more, I became more and more alarmed, though. I was soon telling others what I had learned about the increasingly dismal situation most males find themselves in, not just boys in college attending males. For 7 years, I edited the International Journal of Men's Health and launched a journal of boyhood studies, the first of its kind. I committed myself to understanding what had happened to most men, to blokes, not just to the privileged few that we hear so much about, those who have a lot of money, prestigious positions of power, but most men, and to do something more broadly, not just for the young men and boys I worked with in the consulting room in the classroom, but for the many lads and young blokes out there who are known not to be in anyone's care. As you see, I have been for something, not against anything. No blame. Fast forward, where am I today? I'm in Adelaide for my second delightful visit here. I was looking for some parrots in the tree, but I was here in October the last time, and they've evidently gone for the season, so I missed them. In any case, here I am in Australia, where male studies has already advanced with more deliberateness than anywhere else, thanks to the steady efforts of colleagues such as John Ashfield and other Australian scholars, physicians, policy makers who collaborate with their counterparts in the States, Canada, and the US under the auspices of the Australian Institute of Male Health and Studies. Later this year, as John mentioned earlier, the Institute will launch New Male Studies, an interdisciplinary journal, to disseminate what Male Studies is accomplishing. I'm pleased to say, Pete, I'll be editing it. I've been formulating some recommendations about what we must do next, and that's where I'll take us through the remaining minutes of the symposium today. Allow me to give you a few of these, not all of them, a few of these. In doing so, in making some recommendations, I will also tell you a bit more about what I've been up to and prepare the way for some questions, unless we're too tired and just want to go home. About 8 years ago, after my realization that something was very amiss for my college students and for boys, I put together a psychology of men and boys course. In preparing to teach it, I returned to my psychoanalytic beginnings. I realized we must focus on experience, not just behavior. So I think that is the first thing I would recommend we do when we leave here today. We must try to understand the experience of boys that motivates their behavior being failing at school, defaulting on everyday life, by perhaps unconsciously choosing to go to prison, or impulsively deciding in a heartbeat that it would be better to be dead. As the meager results of 100 years of scientific psychology attest, we learn very little from looking only at behavior, understanding why things happen as they do, and what in particular plays itself out must be based on an appreciation of experience. This, I think, is essential to keep in mind. That would be my first recommendation, that we refocus from the social science perspective that has dominated the study of behavior to a study of a consideration of experience, of what's motivating boys' behavior young men's behavior. Focusing on experience will mean listening to what boys have to say. This is my second recommendation, that we listen to what boys and our remaining fathers have to say. We must listen to those boys who have fallen afoul of the failing family, but also those who have managed to remain optimistic. At Wagner College, the second of seven men's centers on college campuses nationwide was established 2 years ago, as I mentioned. I'm repeating myself here, I didn't know that I'd have a chance to say this when we had the Q&A. But in the safe spaces provided by, and I want to mention the person's name, the Harold and Lynn Thurer Men's Center, and I'll tell you just about this couple. Young males are afforded an opportunity to meet and listen to each other's questions and learn from each other how best to negotiate a very difficult time for them. Harold is an alumnus of the college, and he has a 14-year-old son, and he and his wife were very enthusiastic to provide financial support, which they did for a 2-year startup period this year, which is just over, and another amount for next year. After that, we're on our own, but I'll be looking for other alumni to do this. In any case, these centers are, I think, an essential element in this. What they say, as I said a bit before, to each other remains among them, but I know from them that their discussions often continue in pairs when they leave weekly meetings. Eventually, as I meet with each of them informally, I hear about what is on their minds. What they tell me is that often after an initial hesitancy, nearly all of them have found the gatherings sustaining and often enlightening. So I therefore recommend that we establish such safe spaces for young men, and reported on some examples of those. And I want to add one here, and that is one that I became aware of, one possible setting, and that is men's sheds, which I became acquainted with 4 years ago here in Australia, and there's nothing like that in the States. And as I learned about them here, I found a place for elderly men who gathered together and found support that they could only give each other, but also that these turned out to be wonderful places for mentoring. And so young kids, often enough kids who were in trouble or homeless or fatherless or parentless, could come in these very quiet places, making things in these sheds, making things with hand tools and such, and without a lot of discussion, find support and mentorship in these older men. On the other hand, the older men were finding the youth suffusing them with energy that they could only have fond memories about. Listening to boys is always enlightening, but sometimes useful too. So this fall, on the suggestion of the new moderator of the Wagner Group, a fellow called Jeff, non-college men of the same age from the surrounding community will be invited to join the group. I mentioned that a little bit earlier. And this will mark a new phase in the development of our program. This idea came from Jeff, it hadn't occurred to me, a Bulgarian-born biopsychology major. Something so obvious had not occurred to me. It seemed obvious to him, since he had at least 3 male friends who want a forum, in which to talk to each other about what is happening in their lives. He mentioned it to them, and they said, "Oh, that's cool. When is it starting? When are you getting back to doing it?" He told them about it at the end of the semester. They'll be joining in the fall. But there is, of course, darker news that they tell me. From other young men in the group, I've heard the stories of not feeling welcome on campus, of doubts about their bodies, of family situations in which they were moved between parents during the first decade of their lives, even pressures to marry when they're not really ready. Most guys will now probably not marry until their late 20s. In any case, some are still under pressure by families to do that. For better or for worse, it depends upon the guy. I have also seen their resilience, though, and watched them put into play solutions to the puzzles and problems they face. To allow themselves to talk to each other often requires long periods of time, weeks and months. One member of the Wagner men's group, Rob, told me that he had had a lot of doubts about the value of the meetings. He wrote to me, "I haven't been present much," it's an email, "haven't been present much, and my only excuse is laziness. I am sorry, more so because I haven't followed through on promises like this before. I must change and hope that I can. The only way to reverse this pattern of flaking," does that ring a bell here, and flaking, "will be my efforts. But you know, I have greatly enjoyed every moment I've been at one of the meetings and on the retreat last semester, and I know it has helped me and every other man who's attended. This came to me 2 years after Rob first came into contact with the group, didn't attend much. They came to me privately, but I knew from others that during one of the semester's last gatherings, he had made an impassioned plea that the group continue meetings in the fall. So he turned out to be one of the greatest boosters of the group, though at the beginning he had really serious doubts. I saw him at graduation last month and offered that we meet during the summer and talk more about things. I have an office on campus where I usually meet students, but in New York City there are a number of little cafes that have been around there for years and years, and so I often meet two students, three students, sometimes one student for coffee, and these things are initiated always by them. We meet up. I'm pretty sure I'll have a chance to see how Rob's doing as he sets out, having just graduated. This is part of, I think, the ongoing mentoring idea that we want to think about and find ways of implementing. By the way, when I say the way things are for boys, I always mean the experience of a given boy or man. So I'm moving on now to another point. Young males don't die at their own hands, go to prison, or fail to earn a high school diploma. A certain boy commits suicide. A certain boy with a name is incarcerated or drops out of school. A certain boy is clinically depressed or acts out and is treated with Ritalin. He has a name and his experience is unique. While we will speak about most boys just as we speak about most men, and not that very small group who have gained and retained power that I mentioned before, we must realize that there are only one-of-a-kind individual young males, each of whose situation is unique. Obviously, then, you've guessed that my next recommendation must be that we always think in terms of individual boys, and first do what we can on a small scale, one-to-one, even as we work to bring to public attention how things stand for most boys, which is one of the goals of the work of this group. A further recommendation about what to do next has to do with getting at the experience of quiet boys and young, verbally less proficient men, young men. This will amount to finding settings and situations in which to engage them and transmit to them nothing more than that we value them. My colleague, South African-born professor of English, Dennis Gauss at Springfield College in New England, in the New England part of the States, calls this simply male-positive interaction. We will be busy finding the best practices and settings for such interactions. The traditionally likely venues, schools, and the playing fields may no longer be the best places for this. Next, I recommend that we speak openly about what is good about being male and point out where descriptions, especially of young males' behavior, have been skewed, and in the process, most males, especially young males, skewered by accounts of them that they react to quite rightly by saying mostly to themselves, who are they talking about? Many, when they see themselves misrepresented in the media and even purportedly scholarly publications, turn away in disgust, as they should. We have to correct the profiles that some pundits continue to promulgate. Media propaganda is a powerful social force. When it's male denigrating, male bashing, it harms everyone, men, women, parents, families, and I think the construction of social reality. Let me give you an illustration of this. During freshman orientation week at nearly every American college and university, attendance is required of all incoming students at sessions billed as consciousness-raising sessions on date rape. The boys, who are about 18 years old and have not yet had an academic class, are shamed in these situations by the suggestion that they harbor tendencies to harm the girls sitting next to them. I'm happy to say that in my 18 years I know at Wagner, I know of only one confirmed incident of reported male-on-female date rape. The question comes, why has this seminar been required? Well, we enroll 2,000 students each year, and out of that number, the occasions that I've mentioned are negligible. More important, the girls and boys there tell me it rarely happens, and I believe them. The girls tell me it, and the guys tell me it. It is not a matter of underreporting. The boys are enjoying their sexuality in an environment in which they can experiment with it, and so are the girls, and more and more so. They take responsibility for their behavior and assume rightly that the boys will too. Speaking of the girls there. And by the way, they refer to each other as boys and girls, and so I follow their lead in this. 22-year-olds, and I say, now, well, the men, women in the class, and then, well, the girls. I say, the men in the class, and they say they're boys. Freshman seminars, for example, on on males as sexual predators suggest something that has nothing to do with most males. Instead, we must remind an incoming class about what young men and young women do well. And this needs to extend beyond college to what media representations of what most boys, blokes, do. Next, I would recommend that we recall something unique about young boys, and as far as I can tell, adult males too. This is quite specific. Boys usually prefer doing to saying. A small boy is not likely to say to his mom, to turn to his mom and say, I love you, I really do, let me count the ways. Here's the first, and then the second, and the third. Instead, he brings her a small snake he has captured in the grass in exchange for her having washed his tennis shoes. Or he makes a box for dad to put a snake in, hands it to him, and watches as dad captures one. Does he need to be told he is loved? He does, by both parents. As I noted this morning, one will be unconditional, the other conditional. And this is the unconditional love of the mother that teaches him that he's lovable, and it's the conditional love of the father that's based on his having initiated a relationship with his dad. I think this is really important. So I recommend that we tell boys that we love them. not be embarrassed to use those words. Now, don't expect a verbal response or even a sign that they have heard what you've said. This becomes even more problematic after puberty, when a lad may say to his mom, stop talking that way, that's gross. And I think Celia gave an example of mother-pubescent son closeness. Don't expect that to, the mom has to know when she tells him that she still loves him, even though he's damaged the fender of the family automobile. I also recommend that we recall something else that is good about boys, and again, perhaps men at their best, and that is that they do not always take the world too seriously. Can this be a good thing? I think so. Boys are playful. To borrow an old word, ludic, playful, tricksters, humorists. They do not take sex as seriously as women do. Life for men is a comedy in the classic sense. You recall the U shape of the comedic mask. Things start off at a high point, descend into a difficult time, but return to a high point. This is the life of the trickster, the boy, but also the hero. What else is positive about males, especially young males, that we can recall? It's clear from world religions and mythology that men fully appreciate the connection between the divine, the numinous, and reproduction. What I said before about men taking the consequences of sexuality less seriously needs to be balanced by this consideration, that as procreators, males do sense the uncanniness of life, especially in the procreative act that makes new life possible. We do not need to be grave about what is ineffable, what we can't speak about. Perhaps the only thing to do is smile. Next, I recommend that we reconsider the fabled excesses of men. These cut both ways. Men have done a lot of harm, by the way, mostly to other men, but nearly always at the expense of real power over their own lives, as an American colleague, Warren Farrell, has pointed out for many years, beginning with a book he called The Myth of Male Power. Again, I repeat, I'm talking here about blokes, about most men, not the few who get the attention of the media and a certain mythology that has grown up out there. Lots and lots of men have done a great deal that has been put to good use. Take a few moments later on to think of the answer to the questions, how did you get here today? And what do you see when you look around you? Whether you think about automobiles, trains, aircraft, roads, and the technology that is required to make them function, or this building, its materials, the energy to operate this system, you'll nearly always be led back to the work of a man. And he had something to do with your mom in getting you here as well. If the men in our audience seem embarrassed at hearing this, understand that it is news to many of them, since as a culture in recent years, we have neglected recalling such things. So I would recommend also that we pause at men's incredulity, their inability to believe these days that what they do well is mentioned at all. Do not mistake a dumbfounded response for lack of comprehension in them, however, or a deep appreciation at having been recognized. Remember the boy with the snake in the box, and that most men may not need constant acknowledgement for what they do, but there has to be some, and at this time, a good deal more than they get, I would say. Finally, as I said this morning, we must mentor boys and young men. I believe that only men can mentor boys adequately. To learn to do this, we must revisit the notions of fatherhood and sonhood, as I made a start at doing this morning. By the way, I thought I had invented a new word, sonhood. So I thought, since my computer program spellchecker underscored it in red. In fact, it's been around since the 17th century, but fell out of usage, curiously enough, at the end of the 19th century. Why this happened just when it did deserves the efforts of a good historian. We must restore sonhood a place not only in our vocabulary, but also in our thinking about boys, fathers, and mentors in the context of the overall well-being of boys and men. Let me close by revisiting another observation from this morning. It's one of my pet ideas these days. It occurred to me in the wake of foregrounding Boyd when I began this project a dozen years ago. And that is boys' singular preference for the possible versus the actual. That is what is taken for granted. The actual, what is taken for granted as inevitable and natural. As I see them, boys provide us with a model for the human that we might aspire to, an appreciation of possibility, pure possibility, possibility for its own sake. This allows us to adjust our horizon, shift our perspective, and with imaginative variation, renew our taste for the novel and unexpected. Boys are avid phenomenologists in this. You may not be familiar with this term. Phenomenologists are those who like to let something show itself for what it is, not convinced that it is what we've been told it is. Well, I think we can learn from this perspective that I find to be very much a characteristic of boys. Boys and young men have not given up on doing this, since it seems to be deeply ingrained in them. Sadly, they are not being encouraged, however, to do it. And to that extent, freedom to pursue the possible is constrained, and as a culture where the poor are for it. I'm convinced that this essential feature of boyhood must be honored and valued when I hear from my male students about their dreams and schemes. We must listen to boys, let boys say their experience and permit them voyage. They will be the ones to tell us about what most men can do well and how all of us might do things better, and perhaps even why men have fallen silent. They will revive and inspire us, and perhaps teach us something about how to be human. In this way, they will father us, as Thackeray observed, the boy is father to the man.